And where are we going?
Welcome.
Welcome.
This is Red Eyes Radio.
Regular listeners and newcomers to the program. This is Red Eyes Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and we are recording from the west coast of Sweden. You can hear us every Thursday and Sunday through our website, redicecreations.com. Don't forget to follow along in our news section, and for you guys who want to have full access to Red Eyes Creations Radio, do check out our subscribers section. All information is available on redicecreations.com. And today we have a very special program for you. We have the pleasure of welcoming Mr. G. Edward Griffin to the program. G. Edward Griffin is a writer and documentary filmmaker. He is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, World Without Cancer, The Fearful Masters, and a few of his excellent films include The Capitalist Conspiracy, an inside view of the international banking, The Discovery of Noah's Ark, Seduction of a Generation, and The Subversion Factor, A History of Treason in Modern America. His website that you should check out right away is realityzone.com, where you can find much more information and on must-have or must-see documentary videos, DVDs, of course books and audio CDs. And as far as I know, all of the books and videos that Mr. Griffin is behind are available on realityzone.com. And today we are going to spend some time talking about his book The Creature from Jekyll Island and his film The Capitalist Conspiracy. Very important information that is vital to help you understand what's going on in the world. So I'm very excited to have Mr. Griffin here and to dive into the subjects of today's program. So let's say welcome to Mr. Griffin. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Well, thank you, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Thank you so much again for coming on. I also want to extend my thanks to our good friend Michael Tessarion for helping us making this program today a reality. And, you know, Mr. Griffin, before we kind of dive into the main topic of today's program, I just want to ask you something here. You guys celebrated, of course, 4th of July yesterday, the Independence Day. And with the background that you have and the subjects that you have studied and researched, and considering the concern for national sovereignty and so forth, a day like 4th of July, what thoughts does it bring? Do you feel hope for the future or gloom over how things have turned out, maybe not only in the U.S. but around the world?
Well, Henrik, that's a very profound question, and it's interesting in that last evening Mrs. Griffin and I drove over to the center of our little village here, and they have a nice fireworks display. And as we were sitting there watching these magnificent fireworks up in the sky, and all the people, and especially the children going, ooh, ah, and boom, boom, and I was thinking to myself, I wonder how many people here really are giving any thought to what that means and what this is all about, or is it just a light show and a sound show? And I came sadly to the conclusion that most of the people there had no reflection or not even much knowledge on the real purpose of the 4th of July celebration. And I haven't even thought about what national independence means today, and certainly not what it meant at the time in 1776, mm-hmm. When this whole thing started for us.
Yeah.
Today, we don't have national independence. It's been eroded. It's been chipped away, and not eroded, I suppose. Eroded is the wrong word, because that implies some kind of a natural process
Yeah.
that goes on with the passage of time. No, that's not what happened to our national sovereignty. It's been chipped away.
Mm.
It's been attacked, and pieces of it have been deliberately stolen. And the pieces, each one, have been so small that nobody really noticed it.
Yeah.
But now we come to this present year, and we see that what is standing out there is kind of a like a light and a sound show. Our national sovereignty is all a show, and there's no substance to it anymore. And so, yes, I'm very sad when I think about all that.
Yeah.
And I'm especially sad when I think that the average American doesn't really think about it, or if you were to ask him, he'd probably shrug his shoulders and say, well, so what? And that's very sad.
Yeah. So where do you think we are heading? I mean,
well, I think we're at the very late stage in the creation of what many people at the top fondly call the New World Order, which is translated, that simply means world government based on the model of collectivism.
Mm.
And this has been a long-term goal of certain groups of people, not only in the United States, but all around the world. They all have a connection, and their goal is to destroy national sovereignty, not just for the United States, but for all countries, and to merge them into this this global government. And you might say, well, what's wrong with that? And the obvious answer is there's nothing wrong, per se, with world government, but it's a half a question. It's a half an answer. The question should say, but what kind of a world government are we talking about?
Yeah.
If we were talking about a world government based on the principles of individual rights and personal freedom and respect for personal faith and political views and lifestyle and all of those things, there'd be nothing wrong with it. It'd probably be a wonderful thing and a natural evolution of political systems. But
yeah.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about a system at the United Nations which is based on the model of collectivism.
Mm.
Now, collectivism is a word here in the United States that not too many people are familiar with. They think that means, well, collective action. We all get together and agree to cooperate. Well, no. Collectivism is, especially when it's used by the people at the top who are promoting it, they know exactly what it means.
Mm.
It means a system, a political system, in which the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual is sacrificed willingly, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. And all of that sounds pretty good, but it translates down into total tyranny, because who determines the greater good of the greater number
yeah.
are always the elitists, the political and financial elitists who are in control of the political parties, in control of the media centers. They pretty much control the public opinion,
yeah.
and they lead the masses through this illusion of democracy, and the people vote their dictators into office, and then they're supposed to be satisfied because, well, after all, they voted them in.
Yeah.
And not realizing that they really didn't vote them in because they had to choose between two or three candidates, all of whom were selected by a very small group at the top.
That's right.
And so forth. I'm rambling a little bit.
Oh, no, no.
The point is that we need to ask what kind of a global government. And very few people are doing that.
Yeah.
So what's happening is that we're on the very late stages, in my opinion, of the creation of this new world order. And it's not going to be a pretty thing. In fact, it's already not a pretty thing. But as long as people in our country and in yours, we still have a modicum of a little bit of security, and we still can eat well, and we still can get in our cars and go someplace without having to show our papers at every corner or every 20 miles or so.
Yeah.
And as long as we got our color television and a nice cold beer in the refrigerator, everybody says, well, what's wrong with life? This is a good life.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
They don't realize that this is pretty much the situation, minus the color television, but it was pretty much the situation in pre-Nazi Germany as they slid toward Nazism. So anyway, those are the thoughts that came to my mind on the 4th of July.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, one thing interesting to ponder upon, of course, is what is the kind of the worst case scenario here? I mean, we could end up in a, you know, as you say, very much more controlled society. But in a way, I've been kind of pondering upon this, and it seems like the way things are now, just as you describe, with as long as people have their TV and their cold beer or whatever, people will, in a sense, be satisfied by it. So the question is, do you think that kind of system always will be in place, where we have some kind of prosperity, so to speak, but not in a spiritual sense, but on a more superficial and materialistic sense? What do you think?
Well, I think that's what the people at the top are planning on. I think they're very smart. They have experts at their fingertips, experts in the field of public psychology, mass movements, and they know a lot about how to control the population, how to control their thinking. Mm. The system today is built on mind control rather than body control, although that fallback to sheer force of arms is always there. They're never going to give up their military and their police forces and their jails,
yeah,
and unfortunately their torture chambers and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they found out over the past 50 or 60 years or so that it's much more efficient and much more dependable to control people by controlling their minds, to convince them that their captivity is good for them.
Yeah.
If you can convince a person that his captivity is good for him, he's not going to try and escape.
That's right.
So that's where the game has been played.
Yeah.
And they're very good at that. So now your question arises, is this going to just continue? Will they keep the masses content with their physical pleasures or not? I think not. I think my view of history, and especially most recent history in the last 100 years,
mm-hmm,
when for the first time in history we saw the creation of a new political model called collectivism,
mm-hmm,
and that's the very thing we're talking about, where we're controlling people through mind and ideas primarily, and that's relatively new, although you can trace it back to much earlier stages, and if you want to use religion as a comparable model. A lot of people have been controlled and still are through religious beliefs.
Yeah.
But to change that over to the political world was something relatively new for the last century. Anyway, my view of all of that is that underneath the development that we're looking at today, we see the growth of government and the diminishing of personal liberties.
Mm.
It's continuing. It's not a static model. Government must always grow. It's like a cancer. It must grow. It doesn't get to a state where it says, okay, this is it. This is the perfect balance. It's never done that.
Yeah.
Never. And so I don't see any reason to think that it's going to change today. So the growth of government will continue until it is exactly 100%. And at that point, it won't make any difference if you've got a cold beer in the refrigerator, because it'll probably be a beer which is laced with chemicals,
yeah,
to control your mind, and it won't make any difference if you're watching color television, because everything on the tube will be propaganda. And at some point along the line, I think that even the most dull individual in society is going to wake up and say, I want out.
Mm.
And that's when the system will have to be destroyed.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it seems like if we compare it with, you know, empires of the past, there is a new, even a scientific model, I guess, that they can use now, or even technology, or as you say, where chemicals can be, you know, in place to actually, you know, keep people more off focus, so to speak, and not to realize what system they're a part of. Do you think that this is something that is developed as a kind of a, you know, that the people that are behind the world government are aware of these things and have looked upon the ancient past and the past empires and kind of ponder upon, these empires collapsed, but what do we need to actually have it sustained, to not collapse, to have it perpetual, you know, to be able to, for it to continue? Do you think that is a possibility now with the scientific model and also with technology, of course?
Yes, well, they do think that. There's no question about it. And they say so. And they hold seminars and they write books on it. And they do think so. I don't think they're completely confident. I think there's a little bit of whistling in the dark that goes with that. But they sound very confident. But either way, whether they think it can be done or not, they're giving it the old try. And they're counting on it. And as I say, I don't think that it can be sustained, because I think somewhere along the line, the human spirit, no matter how conditioned it has been through chemicals and indoctrination and propaganda, no matter how conditioned it has been, I think it's something deep in the human spirit that well, at least hopefully, somewhere along the line, will come forth and throw all of this nonsense off.
I believe so too. Actually, I totally agree. Do you see a heightened, you know, what should I say, interest? I guess for research that favor the more conspiratorial view. Do you see that more young people are coming to these subjects, or is it on the same basic level as ever? Do you see any increasing interest?
Yes, I do, and I don't know quite what to make of it. I don't know whether this is a new trend or just a continuation of a long-term trend. I've often asked myself that question. I look back over the quite a few years that I have been following these events, and it seems to me that at every stage along the way, I recall saying to myself and to others that, yeah, I think there's a new awakening happening. I think more and more people are awakening. I can remember saying that 20, 30, 40 years ago. So I have a feeling that it's a continuing process, or a worst-case scenario is that I'm just the eternal optimist, and it's no different now than it ever has been, but it just seems like it is. I don't know which is true.
Yeah.
But I do know that today, with events involving international terrorism and here in this country, that just one law after another coming down the line restricting our freedoms in the name of fighting terrorism or fighting drugs or fighting crime or fighting pornography or fighting something that they have all these terrible imaginary, well, not these monsters, these mental monsters out there that we must fight and destroy. And so that convinces us to, as I said before, the captives become content with their captivity, because after all, we're protecting ourselves against all these terrible things.
That's right.
And they actually become grateful for the fact that these laws are taking away our freedom, because they see that as a form of security against these horrible things.
Exactly. I mean, a terrified mind or a fearful mind or even spirit is going to cling on to the whatever handrails that are given to the people, and through these measures, as you say, like terrorism or whatever in this case, among other things, the surveillance society, and even to some extent, a microchipped population or what have you, can actually be justified, it feels like.
Well, that's the whole idea, and I know there's no longer any doubt in my mind that many of the problems that we have in society that are so frightening have, if not been totally engineered, have been encouraged by these people. They've tried to make them worse so that the frightened factor, the fear factor, will be greater. And you see that all the time. Once you get that perspective, you can see that we're constantly being warned about some, I just use terrorism as an example. They're always thwarting some kind of a terrorist attack, even though the attack doesn't happen, but they thwarted it. and then we find out years later that these guys that they say were the terrorists were some kind of stumble bums, didn't know what the hell they were doing, and probably were on the payroll of the government secret agencies in the first place, and so that the whole thing is contrived for the fear factor.
Yeah.
And once you understand the game they're playing, you can see it. You can see traces of it everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, 9/11 is a prime example of this, considering all the research that has been done on this subject. And do you think events like 9/11 actually help to expose the hidden agenda in the long run?
Well, they both, yes, they help to expose it, but at the same time, they advance it.
Yeah.
So you've got that dual problem or the dual quality of it. In fact, that takes it back to your question. Are we seeing an increased awareness? And I think, yes, we really are, because the plan is unfolding so much more rapidly now and more visibly that you have to be pretty brain dead not to see what's going on.
That's right.
So the only thing left is to decide, is this a natural event? Is this just because of somebody over there in the Middle East hates freedom in some other country? Is that really what's causing all this? And if so, why didn't it happen 100 years ago or 50 years ago?
Yeah.
When we had a lot more freedom? They would have hated us more then, but instead, no, we had good relations in those days.
That's right.
So
that's
the only thing left is for people to decide, is this happening because of forces that are just random and out of control, or is it kind of a master plan? Are people trying to make this happen?
Yeah.
That's the only thing left.
That's right. So the situation that we find ourselves in today, is it somewhere, you know, can we backtrack here a little bit and connect this, for example, with the research that you have done in your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and also, of course, in your film, The Capitalist Conspiracy, considering that, you know, we actually are now in this situation where we actually have, you know, the money system, and we have a history of, how should I say, the takeover of society and going from freedom into a more, you know, fascist type global society. Do you think that the main root of the problem, or the main root of the problem goes back to the economical system and the research that you did when you first wrote your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island?
I think the root, the real the tap root of the problem is not the economic system. I think the economic system is more like the trunk that holds the tree up, but the root that nourishes it, I think, is an ideology.
Mm.
It's a concept that many people get that grows out of their arrogance, out of their egos. It's the concept they get that they say to themselves, well, I'm very privileged, I'm very smart, and I'm grateful for that. But that gives me an obligation to rule society. Because those other people out there are stupid. They don't know what they're doing.
Hmm.
And they're probably going to injure themselves if left to their own resources. So we can't really give them freedom.
Hmm.
Because you understand that this is for their own good. Somebody has to rule and tell them what to do.
Hmm.
And I guess that's my job, because I'm so smart. And I'm grateful for that, but it's my obligation, so I must rule and I must deceive those people for their own good in order to make the world a better place in which to live.
Mm.
And that's the underlying ego basis of megalomania, really. The people want to rule other people.
Yeah.
And in their own minds, they justify it, not just because of being power hungry, although some of them are like that.
Hmm.
I think most of them say that they try and justify, saying, well, it's necessary. Somebody has to do it. It might as well be us.
Yeah.
So I think that's the taproot, the idea that there are social engineers out there, and these are the collectivists, who are going to get all society organized into this super state, and that they will rule the state for the benefit of mankind.
Do you think
that's the taproot?
Do you think that this has happened because people haven't taken personal responsibility, meaning that they have, in a sense, actually allowed this to happen? Is that a possibility?
I think they'd like to say that, and they utilize the fact that many people do not assume responsibility, but the fact is that many people do assume responsibility, and the elitists are determined to run their lives also.
Yeah.
They don't want to make any exceptions. They'll say, well, if you rule your life responsibly, how do we define that?
Hmm.
We define that as you rule your life in exactly the fashion that I think you should rule it. And if you don't rule it in that fashion, then you're not responsible. And we define the word responsible, you see.
Yeah.
So they're willing, theoretically, they're willing to give people freedom to act only so long as they act in exactly the way in which they say they should act. And if they don't do that, then they take away their freedom.
Yeah.
Which means they never had freedom to act in the first place. See?
Yeah.
That's how that works.
Yeah, definitely. I see what you mean. You know, let's dive in a little bit and talk about your book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. I'm very interested in hearing, if you will, a little bit on the background story on it. How did you come upon this research first, and when was this, and how did the book come about, so to speak?
Yes, I think that's a good part of this total picture, because I mentioned a moment ago that the ideology of collectivism is the taproot, and the financial structure was the trunk of the tree. So now we're talking about, in America, we're talking about the Federal Reserve System, which is the trunk of the banking and monetary system in this country. And so The Creature from Jekyll Island is all about the Federal Reserve in the United States. And the title of the book is a little misleading, or I should say confusing, for some people, because they think, well, what's the creature got to do with it? And they think maybe it's like the creature from the Black Lagoon, or it sounds like it might be a sequel to Jurassic Park.
Yeah, see what you mean.
And I had a little fun with that idea. I toyed with it, thinking, golly, maybe if somebody were walking by a bookstore and they saw this book in the window, they'd go in and buy it, thinking they were going to get that kind of a story.
But it is a horror story, I guess.
It is a horror story, yeah. And it is a creature. But yeah. It really has meaning. It wasn't just a clever little title, because Jekyll Island is a real island, and it's off the coast of Georgia here in the United States. It's on the east coast of the United States. Mm-hmm. And it was on that island back in 1910 that the Federal Reserve System was created. It was a privately owned island, and it was owned by a small group of billionaires from New York City, people like J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business and social associates. It was a beautiful place. It was where the families went to spend the cold winter months. They got out of New York and went down to Georgia. And they have a beautiful clubhouse there. And it was called the Jekyll Island Club in those days. And it was in that clubhouse that a group of seven of these wealthiest people in the world went in 1910. And under conditions of extreme secrecy, they created the Federal Reserve System there. Not in Washington, D.C., but on Jekyll Island, away from prying eyes, away from reporters, away from any written record of the proceedings and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so when I discovered that in my early days of research, I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Why would they go to Jekyll Island? And, of course, the deeper I got into it, I discovered that they went to Jekyll Island so they could do this whole thing in secret. Mm-hmm. And then the next question is, well, why did they want to do this in secret? And the obvious answer is, well, they had something they wanted to hide.
Yeah.
They didn't want people to know.
That's right.
The next question is, well, what is that? And so you get a cascading effect of questions and answers.
Yeah.
And it became apparent to me that everything that we need to know about the Federal Reserve System really is contained in the answering of those initial questions as to why this thing was created on Jekyll Island.
Mm.
And so that's why I named the book what it was. Well, let's get to the chase here.
Yeah.
Mm. Why did they hold this meeting on Jekyll Island in such secrecy, and what is it that they were trying to hide? Well, in a nutshell, it was at that time that there was a great deal of concern among the American people about the concentration of economic power into the hands of a small group of these people, these billionaires, these investment firms on Wall Street. The public was becoming increasingly aware that all of the great money transactions, the flow of credit, all the important things that control people's personal and business lives were being concentrated into the hands of a small group of very powerful banks, insurance companies, and investment firms in Wall Street.
Mm.
And so there was a strong political movement to, and this is a phrase that you could read in the newspapers, to break the grip of the money trust.
Hmm.
That was the slogan in those days. And if you go to the microfilm in the library. You can read editorial after editorial and speech after speech about the need to break the grip of the money trust. And so the purpose of the legislation, which was to be called the Federal Reserve Act, in the minds of the American people at least, the purpose was to break the grip of the money trust and to turn control of the monetary and banking system over to the American people, so that it wouldn't be used as a weapon against them. It would be used as a tool on their behalf. Well, as it turns out, that the men who wrote the Federal Reserve Act were the money trust. They were the very guys that the Federal Reserve Act supposedly was supposed to control and break their grip. Now, had it been known that the bill to break the grip of the money trust was written by the money trust, it would have been kind of obvious. And so they had to get off in secret, and they had to, you know, hammer out all the details of what the thing was supposed to be. Then they had to figure out why and how they could deceive the American people so that they would never know that it was written by the banks, the bankers and the money trust themselves. And they worked out the strategy of what to call it, for example. You see, there's another interesting little thing to it. At the time, many of the congressmen were really against the concept of the Federal Reserve system because it is what technically they call a central bank.
Yeah.
A central bank merely means a combination of political and commercial banking power whereby the banks create the nation's money.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing. Well, they don't want to say, well, we got a system here whereby the banks are given a monopoly power over the nation's money. So they give it a mysterious name. They say central bank.
Yeah.
And nobody knows what that means, but you go to school like I did and you remember the phrase central bank and you answer the question on the exam, what kind of a system is this Federal Reserve system, and you say central bank, and you pass, you get your credit, and you get your diploma on the wall,
right.
And you walk out of school without having any idea whatsoever of what a central bank is.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
So anyway, they had this problem in those days. They said, well, okay, we understand that the systems in Europe are central banks, and they said, the congressman now said, we don't want that here. This is America. We want our own unique institution. We don't want to copy those systems over there in Europe, so we don't want a central bank. And they didn't know what a central bank was, but they knew the phrase.
Yeah.
So the guys on Jekyll Island said, all right, gentlemen, how do we convince Congress to pass a law creating a central bank without calling it a central bank? And they discussed this. And they came up with a phrase, well, we'll call it something else. Let's call it federal. That makes it sound like it has something to do with the government.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't. Except the government's going to pass it and say, okay, that's the only connection. And they said, let's add the word reserve. That makes it sound like there are reserves someplace, and there aren't. And then say, let's call it a system. Well, that's more important in those days than it would seem now, because remember, the goal of the voters, at least, was to break the grip of the money trust, which means to decentralize this power away from New York City. And so they wanted to create the illusion of a system of regional banks in all of these, you know, various states around the country. And they built these, the idea was to build these big mausoleum-type structures that looked very impressive, and people could go and look at them and say, golly, Maud, look at that. We got one of them here, right here in our local town.
That's right. Oh. Yeah.
So they created the illusion of a system, when in reality the thing was always designed to be concentrated in New York and controlled from New York. So they came up with this whole thing, Federal Reserve System, and then they added, in some cases, they added the word bank to it, and it's not a bank. So on every word, it's a deceptive concoction, create the illusion of something that is not accurate. And they talked about this on Jekyll Island.
Yeah, and even I know the day that the act was passed, pretty interesting, wasn't this like the day before Christmas or something like that?
Yes, a lot of the senators were going away on Christmas break, and there was, I'm not even sure there was a quorum there to vote for it, but they snuck it through. However, I don't make as big a deal out of that as some other analysts on it, because I think most of those senators and congressmen were already on record as saying that they were going to vote for it, and they recommended it and so forth. So had there been a full assembly there on that day, I'm pretty sure it still would have passed.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, should we drop a few names here maybe for people who aren't familiar? The guys who were at the meeting on Jekyll Island when this was, you know, being taken forward, do we have some names here? Morgan maybe, I know a few. Are there any Rothschilds at the place? Lord Milner, maybe?
I've got the list right here, sure. And there were seven at that meeting. And the first one was Nelson W. Aldrich. He was next to the President of the United States. He was probably the most powerful political figure in Washington, D.C.
Mm.
He was the Republican whip, that's what they call him. He was the lead of the Republican Party in the Senate.
Mm.
He was chairman of the National Monetary Commission, and that's the special body of Congress which was given the job of writing the Federal Reserve Act.
Hmm.
So he was chairman of that.
Yeah.
He was a business associate of J.P. Morgan. He was the father-in-law to John D. Rockefeller, Jr.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were all tied together, not only politically, but socially, and even by blood.
Huh.
The next guy, oh, by the way, they rode on a private railroad car from New Jersey, which is right across the river from New York.
Mm-hmm.
They got on the private railroad car at the railroad station there in New Jersey and went all the way down to Brunswick, Georgia. And that railroad car was owned by Nelson Aldrich. Okay, the next man there was Abraham Piatt Andrew. He was the Assistant Secretary of the United States Treasury at the time. But that doesn't really tell you much about him. His real connections were in banking. The reason he was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury is because he had powerful banking connections.
Hmm.
And so he was really a banker.
Hmm.
Number three, Frank A. Vanderlip was the president of the National City Bank of New York.
Hmm.
That was the most powerful of all the banks at that time. And he represented William Rockefeller, which is the primary investor.
Hmm.
And the international investment banking house of Kuhn Loeb and Company.
Yeah.
Number four was Henry P. Davison. He was the senior partner of the J.P. Morgan Company.
Hmm.
Number five was Charles D. Norton, president of J.P. Morgan's First National Bank of New York, another one of the giants.
Hmm.
Benjamin Strong was there, number six. He was the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And finally, Paul Warburg was there.
Mm.
He was a full partner in Kuhn Loeb and Company.
Yeah.
He was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France. And throughout all of this time, he remained maintained a close relationship to his brother, Max Warburg, who was the head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and the Netherlands.
Ah, I see.
Now, those were the seven. And according to newspaper analysts at the time, I got this out of the old newspapers from that period, they estimated that these men represented either directly through the wealth that they owned themselves or indirectly through the wealth which their institutions controlled, they represented approximately one-fourth of the wealth of the entire world.
Oh, really?
Whew. Yes. Now, there you have, if that isn't the money trust, I don't know what you would call it.
That's right. Oh, my God. Okay.
And so that's why they went to Jekyll Island, because nowhere else could you get those people together and without causing some kind of a notice, you know?
Sure.
And that's why the secrecy.
Yeah.
They were told to arrive at the train station that night, one at a time, not to be seen with each other, not to dine together. To avoid newspaper reporters and all that.
Yeah.
And even when they got on board the private railroad car, they were told to address each other by their first names only, not to use their last names.
Oh, my.
I thought that was strange when I read that. And I found out later from the memoirs of one of the people who attended that that train ride. He said the reason we did that is because we didn't want the servants on board the train and that car to know who everybody was. So they addressed each other by first names only, and in some cases they even took on code names, and they didn't use their first names either.
Oh, my.
They were afraid that the servants might talk to somebody, and then the word might get out in that fashion.
So they knew right from the start that they were up to no good, so to speak, here.
Well, that's what we might say, but, you know, let's be honest. I think that in their minds, remember, these are collectivist mentality.
Sure, yeah.
They were sure that they were going to create something that was going to be not only good for them, but good for society.
Mm, no? Yeah.
They were going to put an end to all these runs on the bank. No?
We are going to continue our talk now with Mr. Griffin in the subscriber section. We are going to talk about his excellent film, The Capitalist Conspiracy, An Inside View of International Banking, and dive into the connections between the left and the right, or the socialist agenda and the capitalist agenda, and how they connect at the very top. We're also going to talk about the upcoming presidential elections in the US and presidential candidate Ron Paul's outlook. And before we round things up for today, I want to mention two websites that you need to visit in regards to our talk here today. RealityZone.com, that we mentioned at the beginning, but also Mr. Griffin's organization, Freedom Force International, that we are going to talk a little bit more about in the next segment. The website is freedomforceinternational.org, and there you can read a lot more about the background of the organization and also how to become a part of it. So more good stuff with Mr. Griffin coming up in the subscriber section. Thank you for tuning in to the program. We will be back on Sunday with Sam Semir Osmanagic to talk about the Bosnian Pyramid. That's going to be fascinating. My thanks to Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. This is Henrik Palmgren. Until next time, take good care.
This is